Our first case for argument is the United States v. Sonnenberg et al. Mr. Jones.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is William Jones. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. And I represented Bruce Sonnenberg in the case below and continue to represent him in this appeal. Sadly, this is a family affair, and there are five other co-defendants in the case because they had similar issues as Bruce Sonnenberg as it relates to the...
You're on a family retainer, so...
I wish, but no, I'm not. The issue that they all shared as far as their argument of the crack powder disparity and what... we are arguing was an argument that was not considered is similar among them all, so I was sent down here to argue that as well. There are some unique arguments as well. One has to do with defendant appellant Cobb as it relates to her claims of that her motion to suppress statements made to police is a unique issue, but talking to their counsel, given that we had a certain amount of time to handle all these cases, he felt it was mostly factual-based and felt it would be best if we just use this time to handle the issues as they relate to the consideration of crack powder disparity. And then lastly, I had a unique issue with Mr. Sonnenberg as it relates to his career offender categorization, and I'd like to start with that. Bruce Sonnenberg has a conviction from Minnesota back in 1985 for interfamilial sexual assault. And I guess I tried to explain to the PSR preparer as best I could that Begay is now the test. And Begay, I said, is the test also in the sentencing memo and at the sentencing hearing. But all I really got back was, well, we've always called sexual assault of a child a crime of violence. So Judge Moody characterized it as unsubstantiated without much more discussion of the new, what I would say is a new test now with Begay. Basically, I got the response was we've done it this way all along. It's always been a crime of violence. And then after the appeal, the McDonald case came to my attention. I raised it as a 28-J letter to the court. And the opposition brief now is no longer arguing, well, it's always been a crime of violence under the guidelines, but rather it's an argument that McDonald is distinguishable in some way. As I replied, I guess I'm struggling to follow that logic because as best as I can see, it's apparent that the government desperately wants to argue the facts of that underlying conviction. But the problem is that it's supposed to be categorically assessed. The first document you turn to is not the facts in the complaint or the police reports, but rather the judgment of conviction. You know, what statute was he convicted of?
Mr. Jones, if we agree with you that the Minnesota statute is not divisible and therefore that the application of the career offender guideline was incorrect, is there anything that would prevent the district court on remand from actually considering the facts of the case?
At the time of sentencing?
Yes, under 3553A.
I suppose not. I don't know that...
In fact, the law expressly provides that no such limits can be imposed.
I would agree, yes.
But the guideline calculation would be different.
Exactly. It would be lower. I don't know that the crack powder disparity was somehow dismissed because it's, in that case, if you're a career offender, it doesn't matter what the disparity is, right? If it's your third strike and you know you're looking at a career offender, perhaps the judge was more focused on a career offender, which I don't think applied.
Can I ask you a question about about that Minnesota statute as it existed at the relevant time? Did it distinguish at all between defendants of different ages?
No, it was just under age 16
for the victim.
Yes,
but for the offender.
Oh, whether they're close in age or separate, I don't believe so.
Okay, different state statutes deal with that in different ways.
I agree. I think there may be something in Wisconsin, but I've never had that come up.
Okay.
But it did identify certain interfamilial relationships that weren't traditionally familiar, like, for instance, someone who just lives intermittently at the house. It didn't have to be blood relative or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It did distinguish between cases of interfamilial assault of a child using force or just having the relationship. This one was one clearly he was convicted of that did not involve that element. So I believe it's not divisible, therefore, categorically looking at it, it's simply not a crime of violence based on the Begay test. Now, as far as the arguments that all the defendants had in common, it's this, a lot of them brought up that it would be unreasonable to sentence him, sentence all these clients within defendants within the guideline, because it's based upon an unreasonable premise, and that is that crack is significantly worse a crime, possession of it, selling of it, than powder. And all the defendants took the position that the court just simply didn't consider it. And failure to consider that argument is error, and it should be considered. It's significant. And, you know, one should keep in mind that at the sentencing, the government acknowledged that there was a crack powder disparity at work and that a sentence below the guideline was justified. So this was not even a situation where he said, I've considered both sides and I'm going with the government, where they're saying, you know, crack powder disparity, you know, there's no disparity here. Perhaps if they took that position, one could say I've considered both sides and therefore you could conclude he was actually considering. But it was both sides saying, yes, there is an issue here at play that was being argued is just an injustice. And I have a cheat sheet here as far as it relates to each of the six defendants. As it relates to whether the court was just simply silent as to the issue, there was no discussion, if I understand right, with Gene Sonnenberg or George Rainey or Margaret Cobb. Now, Andrew Sonnenberg is a bit of a different issue here. There was no discussion, but it was never raised by the defense counsel. However, in talking to appeal counsel, their position is that it was raised by the government. And, you know, how much of an argument are you supposed to make when the government says, hey, we have no problem with a consideration of the crack powder disparity in order to make it a relevant issue? Now, there were two areas, defendants, that there was at least some discussion, whether you consider it forced or not, about this disparity issue. You know, what are we doing in sentencing? Bruce Rainey did enter into a discussion, but I think if you read that transcript, all that the judge really wanted to talk about is, well, how can you predict what the Congress is going to do? How can you predict how we're going to end up? He even suggested, well, how do we know that powder isn't going to just be considered to be sentenced too low over the last 20 years and raise it? Well, that doesn't... That shows his concern with what is going to happen with Congress, not analysis and consideration of the argument that crack is not 10 times, 20 times, 100 times worse than powder. He's only concerning himself, well, you know, how do I know what Congress is going
to
do?
I thought he was responding to the argument that was being made. That by that time, the Justice Department, the new Assistant Attorney General, had given public testimony in support of changing the statutes. But there were also proposals to raise powder to eliminate the disparity, right?
Well, that, again, it wasn't opposed, so I guess no one really addressed these other issues. You know, it wasn't just the Attorney General. He acknowledged in the transcript saying, you know, I understand that there are experts who have said crack and powder have the exact same effect on a person's system. He never really explains why then it would make sense to follow a guideline that's so much higher for crack than powder. And then in my sentencing, you know, I typically just stay quiet when the judge says, is there anything else? But I asked, you know, I said, look, I don't understand. You've sentenced my client to 292 months. That's the bottom of the guideline. And that guideline was calculated based upon a crack-powder disparity, and he agreed with all that. I said, Am I to infer then or understand that you just don't find that as a basis to consider going below the guidelines? He said, well, I just don't get it. And this is the first time he really gave a explanation for why he, you know, was not going in. And he gave just an anecdote. Well, I've talked to crack addicts, and they've said, or he said, I've had crack addicts tell me that it's harder to get off crack than powder. I just don't think that he's considering the argument in a comment like that. Just some sort of, like I say, anecdotal comment like that. I think that he was really married to the guidelines in this case. I don't think that he was considering at all the argument.
One of the briefs, Mr. Jones, seemed to suggest that the district judge did not understand that he had discretion to depart from the guidelines or to vary from the guidelines. Surely this experienced district judge was fully aware of Booker and Kimbrough.
I know it was mentioned. I think that that brief, it may have been Margaret Cobbs.
But it was.
Okay. I think that, what that brief is referring to is, how do we know, other than that he's a very experienced judge, how do we know if he doesn't say, I'm considering this, or I understand that I can go below based on a disagreement, you know, a policy disagreement, but I'm not. I think that's what he's saying there. I don't think... I think he's staying within the four corners of the
Is it fair for us in looking at all these cases to read the transcripts together to try to understand where the district judge was coming from?
I don't think so. I think you have to take one each individually. I think Andrew Sonnenberg would like you to do that, because there's that issue with whether his counsel had brought it up or whether it was an issue. I think that, you know, my decision to press him for an answer, does that mean that he was considering it when he did? If you conclude that's a consideration, would it be fair to say, well, then he must have been considering it in other ones? I don't think it would be, because every defense counsel had their opportunity to present it as they presented it. I think that each one would need to be handled separately. Although they gave me 20 minutes, I really don't think I need any more, and I'll just come back for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jones. Spodero?
Good morning. I'm John Baudry. I'm the United States Attorney up in Madison, and I represent the United States below, and I'm still with the case. Let me briefly address the sentencing arguments, and then I'll turn to the career offender analysis, the McDonald analysis. Judge Moody doesn't need me to come up here and defend him, but I do want to defend his role in this process and what I think is really the dispute. As I see the cases, the district judge is supposed to do three things: calculate the guideline range correctly, give the defendants a chance to talk about the things they want to talk about, 3553 factors, personal, crack powder, whatever, and then address those factors. And that's what happened here. There were unchallenged guidelines for the most part. Everybody raised numerous 3553 factors. This is a series of cases from yet another very poor Native American reservation in my corner of the state. Talked about lots of family problems and so on. They raised the crack powder disparity, so they certainly were given a chance to raise it. He discussed, he probed, and I'm not going to repeat what's in the brief, but with each defendant, there was a discussion. Without the exclusion of Andrew Sonnenberg, who never raised crack powder. But he, Jean Sonnenberg, for example, is talking about how she feels badly for her children. He directly said, wait a minute, you involved your children in this crime. They were the co-conspirators. When Bruce Sonnenberg talked about, I believe it was Bruce Sonnenberg, might have been Bruce Rainey. It was Bruce Sonnenberg, talked about what had happened and how badly he felt about this. Judge Moody said, wait a minute, you did a great disservice to this small community. He was engaging them. He was asking questions. When the attorneys were talking about crack powder disparity, the ones who actually discussed it at the sentencing hearings, he discussed it with them. Now, he wasn't saying, I know I have discretion. I'm exercising my discretion. Those words didn't come out of his mouth. But in response to your question, Judge Hamilton, while I don't think you could read all the transcripts together for all the issues, I certainly would suggest that you can look at them in total to decide, did this judge know ultimately that he had the discretion? I mean, it was only three dates. There were two hearings on each date, July 13, 14, and October 13. Judge Moody came back and forth from Indiana to help out Judge Crabb. When you look at them in total, not only did the defendants raise it orally, many of them and most of them, I think, raised it in the written sentencing memos, each of which he acknowledged both on the record and in a statement of reasons, I've considered your sentencing memorandum. The government, because I felt I wanted to do it after Assistant Attorney General Brewer spoke to Congress, I wrote a letter in each case saying, just so it's clear, this is the Department of Justice's position now. We recognize the court has discretion, and we don't oppose a variance. That was the position we had taken in all the cases in our district, and since Judge Moody was coming from outside the district, I wanted him to be aware of that. There's just no doubt that he knew he had the discretion. What happened here, and I think he made it clear, is he simply disagreed. At the bottom line, in each of the sentences, he said very kindly, very politely, I've heard what you said, and I think in Bruce Rainey's sentencing, he said that was an excellent argument, but I just disagree. And that is really where we end up here. But that's all that's required. He calculated the guidelines. He let everybody submit everything. He discussed it with the defendants and counsel, and then he made his decision. I think, and the one thing, another point I just want to reply to, I guess, from the reply brief, because I see this argument all the time, the criticism of an experienced judge for rote recitation. And I promise myself, if I got the chance, I want to say this. He obviously reads your cases. He knows what he's supposed to do. So when he is discussing this and making his findings at the district court, he does hit those things he's supposed to hit. To do otherwise would, I think, do a disservice to this court's cases. But to do it, then district court judges are criticized for just going, well, I've read your memo. I've considered 3553. And it is all defendants, I think, they want it both ways. It will sound rote. It wasn't rote when one reads the whole transcript. He certainly ends up with a concluding paragraph and a statement of reasons which tracks the requirements of the cases. But in all of these cases, all six defendants, I think it's clear that he procedurally satisfied what this court requires. The sentences were within the guideline ranges. They're presumptively reasonable. The defendants don't like those sentences, and I don't blame them. But that does not mean, of course, that they should be tossed out. Turning to
counsel, before you move to the career offender issue, which I know we want to hear about, can I just ask you one thing that troubled me here? The statement of facts indicated that the government investigation was carrying out controlled buys in this investigation for 4 years. Is that right? From 2004 till 2008.
Now, if I said that's...
You know, it was in the defense brief, but...
No, what happened, as it turned out in the pre-sentence report, there were a couple of buys made by local police forces. This involves the St. Croix Reservation lands, their tribal lands, are cover Barron, Polk, Burnett, and Washburn counties, four counties. There had been a couple of local investigations, but our controlled buys with the informant we used started... I may have this wrong, but I think it was January of 2008 through June, thereabouts.
So you weren't dawdling about closing down the operation?
I hope not.
Okay. When I saw those dates, I was concerned.
No one would. So. That's a fair question. There's no doubt about it. What invariably happens, and I have a lot of experience with these series of cases, is there's a problem. Local police officers, tribal police, maybe get an informant. They make a buy. There were some search warrants done that had nothing to do with what I will call the federal, state, local investigation. When we became involved, it was really a relatively short period of time. We did all the search warrants in June of 2008, and then it was just a question of getting everything together and bringing the charge. Turning to Mr. Sonnenberg's arguments regarding McDonald and the career offender, the first thing I would just like to address is our view of why there is a difference between the Wisconsin second-degree sexual assault statute at issue in McDonald and the Minnesota, what I'll call familial sexual penetration statute. This court analyzed in McDonald that Wisconsin statute. Strict liability offense, the Wisconsin courts had said it was strict liability, this court applied solely the categorical, the residual clause approach, and said it's not purposeful, therefore under Begay it's not a crime of violence. But I think one can, and I would suggest hopefully should or will, look at the Minnesota statute differently. First, it is not, the Minnesota courts have said it's not strict liability. Now, we may be, it may be a thin read here, but what they're talking about is simply the absence of an intent in the statute, the Minnesota court said in Hart, does not make it a strict liability. It simply means it's a general intent. You have to know what you're doing and knowingly, and the issue in Hart came up on the failure to give a jury instruction. So we have the Minnesota court saying not strict liability. The acts described in the list in the statute are purposeful, they're aggressive, they all relate to some sort of penetration, sexual intercourse, oral intercourse, various other
things. Would you agree, counsel, that it's possible to violate that old Minnesota statute in ways that would not make it a crime of violence?
That is definitely true. That's our position.
So the only way then to treat it as a career offender statute, or as a predicate, then is to get it into the categorical approach, right?
If it's the modified categorical. Of the three, the elements, the categorical or residual, the modified categorical. We believe that when that statute says, or any intrusion, however slight, it then gives a list of things that one could believe or one could find are not forceful. However slight, not reading all the things here in open court, but all those things. Given that, and starting then with the modified categorical, when we decide that it is divisible, not under age, not like the court talked about in McDonald, we're not making that argument, but the acts themselves, the description of sexual penetration, the description, the lists of various things that could constitute sexual penetration, after the words, however slight, I think those could be seen as not being
forceful. However slight is just taken from the common law definition of rape, so it's nothing unique about that.
Right. I think as one looks at those acts, I'm just suggesting, Your Honor, that those could be not as forceful.
I agree with you.
Okay. Once we get there, then, of course, the door is opened, and we can look at the documents, which, of course, in any other real-world situation, if I walked out in the street and said, here's what Mr. Sonnenberg did, anybody would say, well, that's horrible, that's violent, that's forceful.
We're not necessarily in the real world.
No, I understand.
We're in the Begay world.
I'm trying to get there, but I missed it. I
considered as I walked here today thinking, I feel like an assistant U.S. attorney who, when I put all these cases around me, there's this little straitjacket, and I'm like, in fact, I was talking about this case, as a quick aside, with a group of Moldovan prosecutors last week. They were somewhat perplexed as to how I said, it's the law. It's a great country. So in this case, what do we have? In terms of the facts, it wasn't one of those, however, slights. It was sexual intercourse with his stepdaughter a couple times a month from 7 to 11 years old. But the
key thing is,
it would seem that when we look to the documents, the key thing is his manner of committing the offense does not fall into one of the possibly, however slight intrusions.
What are the categories, though? I mean, what you're doing is exactly what prosecutors want to do, and it's exactly what Begay told us we can't do. That is, argue the case based on the actual facts. I mean, I will confess that as a district judge, I often preferred to focus on what actually had happened rather than some of this categorical splitting of these issues, but that's not the way it works, and I got rebuked a couple of times for that. Surely not. But what are the categories as you see them here that we should apply?
I think let me back up just a moment. I think, as we said in our brief, that this case, that Mr. Sonnenberg would be a career offender, no matter which of the three, let's just call them three tests, the pure elements test, I do think that the conduct described when it describes penetration, what you have to prove that as an element includes not mere touching. It's much more like the
okay,
batteries.
But look, okay. If you're going with an elements test, you're going to lose, right? Because this statute would apply to a 19-year-old
right.
cousin and a 16-year-old cousin,
yes.
right?
Yes,
okay.
It would.
Which is not going to be violent, aggressive necessarily. So forget the elements test.
The let's cross that one off.
Okay, right.
Let me go back, and I apologize. The court asked a question. We were talking about modified categorical. Let's just stick right there.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I didn't open with that and didn't start with that in the brief is I didn't want the court to think for a minute that we were simply saying, look, we know what the law is, but really look at how horrible this is, because that's not the law. We're not looking at how horrible this is. I think under the modified categorical, again, we don't really look at how often it happened and how this might have been. The categories that one looks at in this statute, I believe, and why is it divisible, are there, as the court said in McDonald, really, does the statute list several categories, some violent, some not? In this case, it lists, in this statute, I should say, separate ways to do sexual penetration, essentially separate categories, intercourse, anal intercourse, oral sex, various things. And then it gets – so those categories, I would contend, if it had been clear that that's the sexual penetration he was convicted of, we would not be having this discussion. But given that he is convicted of sexual penetration, it leaves the question open whether he was convicted of the category within the statute that begins with those however slight words, an intrusion however slight. Into the anal or genital opening or so on, by the body or an object used by the actor. So it is our position that category the separate ways to do sexual penetration, that category of how to do it could be done in a way that is not physically forceful or violent.
All of your categories, though, depend upon looking at the specific facts of the case, right? Ages, relationship, activity.
I think the latter would be true as to activity. The way I think of this and the way I'm suggesting that I think the law allows is that we look at the categories in the statute. There's, let's just say, five of them listed. If he did, and we don't know which one of those he did. We just know he did sexual penetration. That's all we know from looking at the judgment. Since that sexual penetration could include something that arguably is not violent, this however slight category, then I believe we're allowed to go beyond just the charging document, just the conviction, I should say, just the judgment. So to go beyond the judgment, all I'm suggesting that we're allowed to do is to say, well, what did the facts here say? Which one of those categories did he fit into? And since the facts tell us that he fit into the sexual intercourse category, then I suggest that it then does fit into not mere touching, not some slight intrusion category, but much more akin to the physical violence. Parsing the categories.
But that still requires you to consider ages and relationships. Go back. You could have two people not related. You could have a stepbrother and stepsister who have no biological relationship at all.
No doubt about it.
And that would still, if it's sexual intercourse, that can't be your category then. That won't work.
It's the best
idea.
Let me
go to the question I was asking Mr. Jones. And would you agree that if we send this back on this particular issue, mm-hmm. that you would then be free under 3553A to argue the actual facts of the case?
Absolutely. If it goes back, Mr. Sonnenberg, he was at criminal history 6. He was 292 to 365. If he went back as criminal history category 5, the guidelines overlap. It's 262 to 327. Under 3553, the judge absolutely is allowed to look into these facts and see how horrible it was or whatever the judge determines, and in theory would be allowed to give the exact same sentence. I don't say that to minimize the importance of the issue for clarity's purposes as much as anything, but that's how it falls down. That's what I have. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Jones.
Thank you. I just wrote a couple notes in rebuttal. Mr. Beaudry indicated, you know, hey, he gave careful consideration to these arguments, and we know that because during the defendant's allocutions, particularly Bruce and Gene Sonnenberg, he even interrupted them to confront them about that comment. But look at these interruptions on the transcript. I mean, my client, Bruce Sonnenberg, I thought gave a very good, apologetic, and sincere allocution. But that interruption was, you did great damage to your community. It was almost a confrontation. And now I know, I understand that it's his courtroom and he can proceed as he wishes. He certainly is entitled to ask those questions. But if you read these transcripts, Jean Sonnenberg, she was lamenting over what this, how she had damaged her family. And he just twisted the knife a little more. He wasn't considering that those comments. That just is, that is not an indicator that he was giving careful consideration, in my opinion. And if you read it as well, that may cut both ways as far as whether he was considering any of those arguments. Now, Mr. Beaudry also indicated that he obviously reads your cases, and so he was hitting the right buttons as he went along, and this wasn't just a rote sentencing exercise. He apparently didn't read Begay, you know, and I'm not here to criticize him, but no one would listen to that argument, and that was a very, it is a very germane argument and a hot topic. So I guess I'm just not persuaded by that argument either. I think as it relates to these arguments that were made in the crack powder disparity and other 3553, I mean, is it sufficient to take a judge's comment and say, I just don't find it persuasive, and leave it at that? I don't think that shows consideration of an argument or creates a sufficient enough record to conclude that. And then the last thing is, again, I have to take issue with the assertion that, look, I'm not trying to get to the facts of Bruce Sonnenberg's conviction so I can emote emotions and say, look how horrible this is. I think if you read that brief, that's exactly what it is. It's literally climbing over itself. Not literally, but it's climbing over itself metaphorically to get to those facts. And that's not correct. And there are other facts that should be relevant. This is something that happened 25 years ago, 1985. He got probation for it. I mean, there's a lot of other issues that if we want to have a case within a case, we can do that, but that's the whole purpose of doing this categorically, so we don't have that. We don't have to pull up the whole case. It's just an analysis of the statute, what he ultimately was convicted of, and whether or not that is a crime of violence, and I don't think it is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones, you have an additional thanks to the court for accepting the appointment in this case. The case will be taken under advisement.